laws, from state bills approving medical marijuana to a host of referendum initiatives inspired by Proposition 215, are underway in at least 11 states and the District of Columbia this year. Medical marijuana initiatives will be on the ballot in Alaska and possibly Maine. Arizonans will vote on restoring parts of Proposition 200, and petition campaigns are on in Florida, Colorado, and Washington, D.C. Oregon voters have a chance to reject the state legislature's attempt to recriminalize possession of pot, and activists there and in Arkansas are gathering signatures for initiatives to make herb as legal as liquor. But except for a research funding bill in California, this year's crop of medical marijuana legislation is unlikely to go anywhere in the nation's state houses, where many politicians fear the slightest taint of being considered soft on drugs. There aren't many snowballs in hell today, said Matt Badalucco, an aide sent to New York State Assembly member Richard Gottfried, a Democrat of New York City, who sponsored an unsuccessful medical marijuana bill last year. In 1997, medical marijuana bills were introduced in 12 states. None of them got as far as a floor vote. It really doesn't seem like the legislatures are that valid an option now, says Paul Armentano of Normal. State by state. Sponsors of initiatives have had more success, even though many states require them to collect signatures from 5 to 10% of the voters to get on the ballot. In Alaska, a medical marijuana initiative backed by the Los Angeles-based Americans for Medical Rights qualified in January with over 25,000 valid signatures. Americans for Medical Rights is suing to get a similar measure on the ballot in Maine. They had collected slightly more than the 51,000 signatures required, but city officials in Portland failed to evaluate about 3,500 signatures handed in there before the February 2nd deadline. AMR is also planning initiatives in Colorado, the District of Columbia, where it's called Initiative 61, and possibly Nevada. In general, the AMR initiatives would exempt patients and caregivers from arrest for marijuana if they have specific symptoms and illnesses, the big five or six conditions, says AMR's Dave Fratello. Possess or cultivate less than a specified amount, 1 to 1/4 ounce in Maine, 2 ounces and 3 budding plants in Colorado, and register with a government agency that would issue them ID cards. Other medical marijuana users would have an affirmative defense enabling them to put their medical necessity into any court record. Some of these AMR provisions have angered numerous local activists who are pushing their own initiatives. One such group is the Colorado Hemp Initiative Project, which calls AMR's 3-plant maximum woefully inadequate. Colorado requires 55,000 signatures. In the District of Columbia, where last year an ACT UP-sponsored initiative missed getting on the ballot by 800 signatures, the group is resurrecting it as Initiative 59. It contains a special definition of primary caregiver, allows district residents to set up nonprofit corporations to furnish marijuana for authorized patients, and requires the city government to come up with a plan to enable getting medical marijuana to Medicaid and AIDS patients who need it. Both ACT UP and AMR, and AMR again is the Medical Rights, Americans for Medical Rights, want to get on the ballot for September 15th, the date of the hotly contested Democratic mayoral primary. They each need 17,000 signatures by May 15th. In addition, Oregon voters will consider whether to approve the state's 1997 attempt to increase penalties for pot possession. Another group, the Committee to Restore and Regulate Hemp, is gathering signatures for the Oregon Cannabis Tax Act, which would legalize the sale of herb in state liquor stores. They need 75,000 valid signatures by July 2nd. As of late January, they had 40,000, says Paul Stanford of the Committee to Restore and Regulate Hemp. In Arizona, two separate measures to restore Proposition 200, the 1996 medical drug initiative, which was hamstrung by state politicians, are on the ballot. One would restore doctors' rights to prescribe marijuana. The other bars jail terms for nonviolent drug offenders until their third conviction. In Florida, a coalition of medical marijuana activist groups has decided to set their sights on the year 2000, as they need 435,000 signatures, including 43,500 by the end of this year, to get their proposed initiative on the ballot. It would amend the state constitution to give patients the right to use medical marijuana when a doctor certifies that it would be medically appropriate. The coalition can't afford to hire signature gatherers, says Greg Scott of the Coalition Advocating Medical Marijuana in Fort Lauderdale, but has gotten a remarkable response out on the streets. In a September 1997 Florida voter poll, 63% of Floridians said they would support such an amendment. In Arkansas, Fayetteville lawyer Larry Froelich is campaigning for what he calls the elegant solution, a three-paragraph amendment to the state constitution that prohibits prohibition, encourages the state to regulate and tax marijuana like alcohol and hemp like any other agricultural product. The legislature shall make no law prohibiting the cultivation, possession, possessing, or sale of cannabis by persons over the age of 21, it declares. Though Froelich says there's a widespread support for legalization in Arkansas, he and other activists there say many people are afraid to endorse it publicly. It needs 71,000 signatures, one-tenth of the state's electorate, by July to get on the ballot. As of late January, he said it had several thousand. On the legislative front, California is likely to pass State Senator John Vasconcellos' SB 535, authorizing $1 million for the University of California to establish a medical marijuana research center. Since last year, when it fell two votes short of a two-thirds majority in the State House, the bill has gained Attorney General Dan Lundgren as a co-sponsor, a move some welcomed as the equivalent of Nixon going to China, says the AMR's Fratello. A section of the bill setting up a task force to study how to distribute medical marijuana was deleted out of fear it was, quote, impeding the bill's progress, says Rand Martin, Vasconcellos' chief of staff. However, the San Jose Democrat has invited Wilson, Lundgren, and Federal Attorney General Janet Reno to a summit on the issue and may introduce more legislation later this year. But in Washington, one of the state's activists were most optimistic about, a bill to establish a medical necessity defense for patients and doctors, died after a January 20th public hearing. Staffers for State Senator Alex Decchio, Republican of Yakima, chair of the Senate Health Committee, said he held the hearing mainly to educate fellow legislators, but didn't want to enact medical marijuana legislation so soon after the defeat of Initiative 685 last November. State Senator Gene Cole, Democrat of Seattle, the bill's sponsor, says activists are more likely to try to get an initiative more specific than 685 on the ballot. And this is a very interesting article. It continues about other states, and I fear I may be boring those of you who don't want to hear all the details about New York City. But even though the state legislatures are turning this all down, there's a really kind of encouraging story in High Witness News. This is the section of High Times that concerns itself with these human rights struggles about, I guess they have their drug or their marijuana hero of the month. I'm looking for it now. It was quite a hero. I was really impressed. And here he is the Freedom Fighter of the Month. His name is Michael Nelson. And it's the article is by Pete Brady called Lighting Up Darkest California. I'm going to read a little bit about this before I sign off, since we're about to end our show today. Chico, California, Michael Nelson, a 35-year-old resident of a rural county which voted against California's medical marijuana initiative in 1996, decided last year that he was tired of living like a criminal. "I've got hepatitis C," he explains, "which is an incurable, sometimes fatal disease. The symptoms of the disease and side effects of the drug I take for it, interferon, are really bad. Headaches, nausea, cramps, depression. It can make life really miserable." But Nelson, a former mechanic who now survives on Social Security disability payments, discovered that marijuana relieved his misery. He obtained a prescription to use it, written by a licensed medical doctor. "We had passed Proposition 215 and I felt everything was totally cool," Nelson remembers, "but I kept hearing how local officials weren't happy about 215 and were going to bust people anyway. So I thought it was time for me to make a stand. It's like Dennis Perone said, they always told us we had to change the law. Well, we changed the law. Now leave us alone." Nelson, who has acquired the nickname Medical Michael, made a stand. He called the local daily newspaper, the Chico Enterprise Record, whose main contribution to the debate on Proposition 215 had been regularly running letters from a local eye doctor who claimed marijuana had no medicinal value. Nelson had a different message. "I told the editor I was a medical marijuana user and that I had a big old garden of homegrown medicine right there in my backyard, which they were welcome to photograph and write a story about me too," he recalls. The editor promptly dispatched a photographer and reporter to Nelson's duplex home. "When I was growing my plants," he says, "I wasn't really worried at all. I mean, I'm sick and I might die soon anyway, and I think maybe we're in a democracy and the law is the law. One day the old guy next door comes over and tells me he had roofers working on his roof and they were looking down into my yard at my medicine. I was afraid he'd bust me, but all he said was, 'More power to you, boy. You got any of that stuff dried and ready to toke?' The article about Nelson got huge play on the Enterprise Records front page. A photo of him standing behind a gigantic sativa plant with crystalline buds glistening in the Northern California sunshine was accompanied by a sympathetic article in which he described his plight, criticized officials for persecuting cannabis buyers clubs, and demanded that police stop arresting medical cultivators. Nelson, his mother, and friends worried that the article might provoke a heavy-handed response from authorities, but his gamble paid off. The county's district attorney, who had previously expressed skepticism about medical marijuana and vowed to prosecute users regardless of 215, made an amazing promise. If Nelson, as he says, has a doctor's permission to use marijuana, and if he's only growing the drug for personal use, he should have no legal problems, Butte County District Attorney Mike Ramsey told the Enterprise Record. Local marijuana activists who had been planning to leave or sue Butte County because of its repressive pot policies were stunned by Ramsey's statement. Many hail Nelson for having the guts to risk jail to test the government's response to Proposition 215. This guy could easily have been busted, explains activist Mary Wilson. Butte County is not known for progressive policies. We saw the article and thought he was a stupid guy to be advertising that he was growing. Everybody thought he'd get busted or ripped off. Instead, he basically forced our DA to guarantee to uphold medical marijuana. I consider that a major achievement, especially around here where most of the people are backwards-assed DARE grads. We're talking, of course, about Michael Nelson, reading from High Witness news section of High Times, and we're talking about Chico, California. Since the article appeared, Nelson has grown two seasons' crops of herb. Police have not hassled him. I really respect how the police have left me alone. I don't even shut the curtains, he says. I have copies of my prescription near the front door and around the house, in the grow room and out in the yard where I put my plants in the sun. I figure that if a thief comes around, he'll see he's stealing medicine, and if the law comes around, they'll see my newspaper article and leave very politely. He admits that calling the newspaper was impulsive and reckless, but says, if more people came out of the closet about growing pot and showed the police, they'd never be able to arrest us all. They'd just give up, and we'd win this thing. If everybody that grew and smoked herb just went out in public and did it, they'd never be able to build enough prisons for all of us. With his 15 minutes of fame behind him, Nelson contends that the full-time struggle of staying alive with hepatitis C is quite a struggle. He has a new garden with several two-tall sativas growing in soil, bat guano, and vermiculite. There are days when he is too sick to get out of bed, too weak to prune and water his plants, too despondent to care if he lives or dies. Hep C saps his will to live, he explains, but a quick toke of herb lifts his spirits and gets him back on track. Still, hepatitis is a dogged virus. It really killed my liver, Nelson said. I wish there was a cure. Even the good herb can't cure it. It can only make me feel better. I wish I could get this damn virus out of my system. But I'm glad I live in a country where people have compassion for people like me, and where even the guys with guns and badges are willing to respect what's good and right. And that, again, is a story by Pete Brady about Michael Nelson lighting up darkest California in the May issue of High Times. And just in time, because it was high time that reckless woman, reckless herself, arrived. Hi, Reckless. Premiums 96.3 FM. Hey, just in time for your evening edition of Bathrobes, Beers, Broadsides, Civil Rights for the Poor in Santa Cruz. 2 hours of interviews, talks, chats, debates, snide comments, and occasional musical interludes with me. I'm your host, Bathrobes Pier, Robert Norris, so stick with me and stay on board. We're going to be dealing with some special guests. We've got taped interviews from Theodora Carey, Stephen Switzer, Becky Johnson, Berkeley's John Vance, San Francisco's Judy Appel, Berkeley's Police Review Commission head Aaron Handel. We have written reports from Prescott, Arizona, a High Times update, and your own Bathrobes Pierre Robert here is going to read the speech that didn't quite make the cut for City Council on Tuesday. Live guests David Silva and Marco Maroney, plus the anonymous guest who is completely anonymous, and he's in fact saying nothing but grinning wildly. See if you can guess who he is if he says anything. Special prize to anyone who can come in with the proper name. So stay tuned to Bathrobes Pier's Broadsides. DiMaggio, And that's, of course, We Didn't Start the Fire, an unauthorized playing of Billy Joel's song here on Bathrop Spears Broadsides 96.3 FM. We're going to begin with some stuff we were unable to play last show, an update from San Francisco by Coalition on Homelessness attorney Judy Appel, who has been covering the situation up there, fighting harassment by the police against the thousands of homeless people that are in San Francisco without any shelter and who are simply being victimized daily and often nightly by the police department. Stay tuned.
You are attorney, a civil rights worker, and I don't know what else you are, but you're certainly putting a lot of time on issues of poor people and homelessness. What's happening up in San Francisco?
Oh, that's a broad question. There's a lot happening up in San Francisco.
Well, so the last time we talked, you were fighting the good fight. See that folks in Golden Gate Park who were getting driven out didn't get driven out and sent to jail at the same time. You've also been working with vehicular residents.
Well, we can start with Golden Gate Park. And what's happening at Golden Gate Park is that the Department of Recreation and Parks has decided that they're going to do daily sweeps of the park. And so what they've been doing is going through the park every single day and going and finding people who they believe are staying in the park and taking their property from them if they're there, giving them what they're saying is a reasonable time, but it's usually maybe 5 minutes to grab what they can and leave. And if people aren't there, just taking people's things, and the reports we're hearing are taking people's things and throwing them away. What we're doing, there's a couple things we're doing, but what we've done already is we're assisting a large number of people in bringing small claims actions against the city or administrative claims against the city, and we've already filed 12, and we have another group that are preparing to file to hold the city accountable. We're also awaiting the city's new policy that should be coming out soon, which we anticipate is going to be an even worse policy than the one that already exists. We have been, other things that are going on in the city is that there has been an increase over the last, I'd say, 4 months in the number of people whose shopping carts are getting taken. So recently, Amos Brown, who's one of the supervisors here, who's also a reverend, called a hearing on shopping carts, and we kind of turned the hearing around into a discussion of what the city can do to try to, kind of recognizing, have the city recognize that the shopping cart question isn't really one that is...
Didn't Brown initially...
That homeless people aren't solely responsible for the shopping carts being taken, which is what the stores have been saying. And Brown, as it has been, was initially trying to use this as a way to bring about a lot of anti-homeless PR. Mm-hmm. And so he's basically used the shopping cart issue as a way to bring about yet another crackdown of people who are homeless and have all their belongings out on the streets. And what we did is we made a proposal to Safeway and Lucky and some other stores that instead of having the police come in and take people's property, that what we should do is set up a system through which people's shopping carts would be their own, so that shopping carts would be, that the stores no longer are using, would be renovated and the markings from the stores would be taken off and people would be able to have them as their own personal property.
Lucky's went along with this, right?
Well, Lucky initially said they were interested and Safeway said they were interested. Unfortunately, I think because of some of the negative press, Safeway is now not returning our telephone calls, so I'm unclear if Safeway is still going to have that commitment to doing that. But the positive thing is that it kind of turned the debate away from, you know, what can we do to fuck with homeless people.
Mm-hmm. Has it slowed down the confiscation?
Like, we haven't had, to be honest with you, reports of people's shopping carts being taken very much. By DPW since that hearing, but I don't know if we just haven't heard it, because we do know that they've been taking a lot of shopping carts from Civic Center, and that's actually Rec and Park's been taking it as a part of the whole, they're kind of expanding the Golden Gate Park sweeps, and they're also taking people's property in shopping carts from Civic Center. So we're having a really drastic increase in people losing their property all around the city.
Now, you were also having confiscation of vehicles big time, I guess, in the fall. Is that still happening, or is that stopped?
You know, people's vehicles get taken on a regular basis. I probably have an average of maybe one person a day who come in for assistance in getting their vehicles back. There's a couple of cops particularly who have it out for kind of make it their business to make it impossible for people to live in their vehicles. And so we continue to work on that on several different grounds, and we finally have a meeting set up. It's taken 2 months. We finally have a meeting set up with Pat Norman to follow up on that hearing, a hearing that we had in front of the police commission about a month and a half ago, and the meeting's going to be in the beginning of April. And we're going to talk to her about the specifically the things that she can do something about, which are the police using their discretion to not target and focus on people who are living in their vehicles like they're currently doing.
Now, all this is against a background of a year and a half's worth of negotiations with the mayor around setting up an area where people can park in their vehicles and living in, right?
Right, well, that's part of what the work is that we're doing. Just to finish where I was going with that, there's I'd say three different things we're working on. One of them is to get the police to deprioritize and put a moratorium on the tows that they're doing with people. The second thing is a project that some people are trying to push, which is to have some special permits issued for people to be able to stay in their vehicles, built around a program that some individuals of the Vehicularly Housed Residential Association have put together. And finally, and by far our biggest project is just that, trying to get a lot together where people would be able to have a community where they would pay some rent and have basic amenities and be free from police harassment.
Have you had any
Actually, moving forward, we have identified a site that certain members of the Porter are interested in helping to transfer to us for this purpose, and people in the community like that site, and we're moving towards the next step, trying to identify how that will happen and if that's a realistic site. The thing that's been holding us up is finding a site where we're going to be able to do this.
So St. Martin de Porres, of course, is a long-time provider of food and clothing to homeless folks. Is that's for those benefit of folks here in Santa Cruz who don't know St. Martin de Porres. It's a charity up in San Francisco.
Yeah, well, I'm sorry,
I was just clarifying what St. Martin de Porres is, the group that's going to be, that's offering this kind of property, is that?
No, the port. It's the port of San Francisco.
Oh, the port. Oh, I'm sorry.
No.
Strike that. You know, there was a time in the fall when District Attorney Terrence Hallinan had jumped on board this, eliminate the homeless from the parks, there are a bunch of arsonists, et cetera, et cetera. And he was calling for harsher penalties for sleeping. Is that tidal wave of hysteria passed?
Yeah, I mean, Hallinan was saying that, and we were surprised and just, pissed off, obviously, that Hallinan, with his progressive past, was making those statements in the press. They haven't moved forward with that, and, we're relieved about that, but they do continue to issue citations for sleeping and camping on a really continuous basis. And what actually happened, and it often happens in the wintertime because of the rains, but I think particularly because Golden Gate Park, because of the daily sweeps and the fact that they fenced off a large portion of the park where many people used to hang out. The number of citations for camping have gone down over the last couple months, but the number of citations given to people for staying in the doorways has just increased. So that just shows us once again that what ends up happening is that people just get moved from one place to another. And obviously using the police as a major force in San Francisco to address homelessness doesn't address homelessness, it just criminalizes it.
There was a conflict in the Hague, I understand, about the local merchants organizations were concerned about the homeless people that the police had forced out of the park into the Hague area. On the other hand, there were groups in the Hague that supported the right of people to be in public places like the Hague-Ashbury Neighborhood Council. Was any resolution reached on that, or as you simply said, is it just a...
Yeah, that's an age-old debate. Hague has always come out as a group that has supported the civil rights of homeless people, and there's always been progressive groups in the Hague that are always going to be coming out against those civil rights and not concerned of looking at really progressive long-term solutions, but instead looking at ways to just drive people away. And the recent, every time there's something like the recent sweeps, groups like RAD come forward and
RAD is
began to try to ride the wave of oppression, and that's the same thing that happened this time. So there was a community meeting that RAD called.
RAD is?
People came, and it was disrupted. And a lot of people really spoke out, and it ended up, I think, in a stalemate at that point.
RAD is a group against drugs, neighborhood group against drugs or some such thing?
Residents against druggies or something like that.
Right. You know, in Eugene, Oregon, they decriminalized sleeping in industrial zones. Have you had much communication, and has that example had much impact on City Hall in terms of realizing that a major city can decriminalize sleeping without having everybody come to town and abuse the situation?
I think that here, we're actually in an interesting situation in San Francisco, because we're in a situation where I believe that the neighborhoods and most of the residents of San Francisco are interested in looking at alternatives like decriminalization, but not calling in the cops and coming up with other ways to address the way homelessness affects everyone in our neighborhoods, both homeless and non-homeless people, mm-hmm. in ways other than calling the police. And so I think what we're seeing is a rise in the number of neighborhood groups that are looking at alternatives other than just calling in the cops. At the same time, though, at City Hall and in the police department, you have the opposite trend. The number of citations and like we've said, the number of incidents of using the confiscation of homeless people's property as a way to drive people out under the same mentality as the criminalization, mm-hmm. The citations and arrests. So I'd say that there's no real discussion going on in lawmaking circles about easing up on things.
So is Brown pretty much as bad as he has been in terms of the 2.5 times as much in terms of matrix tickets as the previous mayor, Jordan?
The number of citations actually did go down last month, and I think that was in large part because it's the winter month. I have not had a chance to compare them to the years before. Mm-hmm. I mean, we had another thing that happened is that they opened up an emergency shelter in San Francisco, which they opened up three community-based shelters for the harsh winter that we've had. And those, although they had their problems, were pretty much a success. Then they, due to pressure from those communities, they closed the house communities and the merchants. They closed the those community shelters, and they opened up a large shelter in the industrial area of San Francisco, which is really problematic. But it means that there have been anywhere between 400 and 600 beds where people have been staying, where they've been off the streets. So you kind of have to take that into the mix, and we haven't done that evaluation yet.
What's the death toll, as far as you know, so far this year? Is it up, down, or in the middle?
You know, I don't know. We calculate those numbers at the end. I can say from where we sit, we've had, it seems like this winter, an incredible amount of people that we know have passed away, and at least one that I know of as a direct result of the property confiscations.
Judy, is there anything you want to add, or any contact numbers?